This Wednesday, June 14th, is Flag Day. I have never preached a sermon commemorating Flag Day, but I will today. My father passed away in 1999, and I found that I could contact my congressman and have a flag flown over the Capitol in his memory, and then they would send that flag to me. So I contacted our congressman and received that flag. So the flag I fly flew over the Capitol. I know what they do. They hoist it up and then take it right back down. But that's okay. It flew over the Capitol in honor of my father. And so that's the flag that I fly. I trust you will fly the American flag this Wednesday on Flag Day. Many are doing what they can today to destroy the foundation of our nation. The so-called promoters of love are displaying by their outward actions what is in their heart. Hatred for God, hatred for His Word, hatred for the Declaration of Independence and our Constitution. So they disrespect and seek to destroy anything that symbolizes and promotes the freedom that we enjoy. They seek to destroy our system of justice, our economic system, statues of the great men of the past, and the flag of the United States of America. When the American Revolution broke out in 1775, the colonists, as I understand it, were not fighting under a single flag. Instead, most regiments were participating in the war for independence against the British, and they fought under their own flags. George Washington realized that the first flag flown by the Continental Army was too similar to that of the British. I get this from a website called What is Flag Day? It's on history.com. And so since it was so similar to the British, and was not a confidence builder for the revolutionary effort, legend is that in June of 1776, he commissioned Betsy Ross, a Philadelphia seamstress, to create a flag for the new nation in anticipation of the Declaration of Independence. On June 14th, 1777, the Second Continental Congress passed a resolution stating that, quote, "The flag of the United States be 13 stripes, alternate red and white, and that the Union be 13 stars, white in a blue field, representing a new constellation." In 1916, President Woodrow Wilson marked the anniversary of that decree by officially establishing June 14th, that's this Wednesday, as Flag Day. I don't know what the flag means to you, but it really upsets me when people desecrate the flag. Some time ago, when Benjamin was training to be a Green Beret, they put him through what they call SERE school. S-E-R-E. An acronym that stands for Survival, Evasion, Resistance, Escape. They taught him what to do. They taught these guys what to do if you're ever captured. And trained them to resist, giving information and attempts to break them. And told them, "We have your back. Don't lose hope because we're going to come get you." And they taught them the POW Creed. I know this because I talked to him again this last week and said, "I want to use you as a sermon illustration. It's Flag Day." So I wrote some of this stuff down to make sure that I got this right. So prior to the capture, then they let these guys go. And they knew they're going to get captured. That was part of the whole plan. And so they're captured. And they treated them as closely as possible as captors would treat captives. Even beating them. They had trained actors who were their captors, who knew how to prey on their hunger, to prey on their tiredness, to prey upon pitting them against each other. And they practiced psychological warfare on them. You know how you watch a movie and it seems so realistic it bothers you? They were in the movie and it just didn't seem to be realistic. They were convinced, because of their tired, weak body, they were convinced this was real. They would pull these guys aside and put a bag over their heads and interrogate them. Slap them around, punch them. And then treat you like their best friend. Psychological warfare. At times they would list the crimes of America to cause you to doubt what you're fighting for. Oh, you enslaved people. Your country enslaved people. You fought a war in Vietnam that was worthless, trying to break these guys and try to get you on their side. At times they would place these guys in a box where they couldn't move. Give them no food. Put them in hospital scrubs. He said they were constantly forced to say boots, B-O-O-T-S. Anytime they wanted them to get them, they would say, you have to say boots. Every time you march, every step you took, you say boots, 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 boots. It was meaningless. But the whole idea of saying that was to break them down, to make them submissive where they could not resist. You say what we say, boots, boots, boots. He remembers starving, but being offered an option. Burn the American flag and we'll feed you. In fact, if you don't burn it, we're going to beat your friends. That was the option given. And then they would say, what's the big deal about burning your flag? People in your country do it all the time. It's not that big a deal. He said it was very effective. And they got to the place where they were convinced they would never leave this POW camp. They were so tired, so hungry, so beat physically, so beat down mentally, so confused that they were persuaded that they were POWs. At times they'd hear gunfire and the guards would quickly throw them into a concrete cellar. They were caused to think this is the day of our rescue. But no. Then they'd pull them out, start kicking them, start beating them again, burning the U.S. flag, making these guys mad. Every morning they would try to get these guys in training to salute their enemy's flag. And they refused. Just when they were on the brink of breaking, one day they were in the cellar and they heard the gunfire going off and they were brought out and told to salute the flag. And again, they thought they were going to turn and see the enemy flag. But they turned, and there was the American flag. And a bunch of old, he called them old POWs, were standing there, an active Green Beret had come to their rescue. And he said the guys wept. You see, the flag does mean something to people. And when you're caused to understand what it stands for, you'll do almost anything to defend it. What was the name of that female who was a basketball player who went to Russia? Would not stand for the flag, and now she does. Welcome to being a patriot, at least somewhat. I think it'd be good for the whole Democrat Party to go to Russia and learn to appreciate our flag and start saluting it and understanding what it means. I proclaim the American flag as my pride flag. This month of so-called pride, taking the month of June and desecrated it in their debauchery. But the Sodomites, they have a flag. It's freedom of speech to burn the American flag, but those who have contempt for the American flag accuse you of hate if you have contempt for their flag. How twisted. You've heard of cultural appropriation, right? You can't, in fun, paint your face black because that's cultural appropriation. You're looking like a black man. You can't do anything that somehow appropriates the culture of another person. And yet, these perverts have desecrated the rainbow. They have appropriated, let me say, they have misappropriated the rainbow. Flaunting in the face of God their pride in debauchery. Why not? Pride is associated with Sodom and Gomorrah. We're going to turn to one main passage of Scripture, but right now I'd like you to see Ezekiel chapter 16, what the Lord says about the pride of Sodom. Ezekiel chapter 16, verse 49, "Behold, this was the iniquity of thy sister Sodom," speaking to Judah. The very first thing mentioned there is pride. Pride. "Fullness of bread and abundance of idleness was in her and in her daughters. Neither did she strengthen the hand of the poor and needy." So the Sodomites will say, see, there's nothing mentioned here about homosexuality. But I take you to the next verse. "And they were haughty." Again, the main characteristic of these people is haughtiness and pride. "And committed abomination before me. Therefore, I took them away as I saw good." They committed abomination. You know, most sins stay in the closet due to their shamefulness. These practitioners, these Sodomites, proudly parade their depravity. Whoever has a parade celebrating perversity, debauchery, depravity, corruptness, vileness. Whoever parades that? Adulterers have enough sense not to do that. And once this wickedness of sodomy is so arrogantly celebrated, soon to come, as we are witnessing, is transvestitism, bestiality, pedophilia. I once went to a rally that my pastor was having in Wichita, Kansas, back in the 70s. My brother and I, Terry, were there as his bodyguard. I don't know why he chose me, but I guess I was just a college student, and we stood in the back. This is at a main convention center in Wichita. This is when Christians were rallying against this wicked vileness, and we were there in the back watching to make sure nobody came racing across the stage. We were supposed to do something if they did. And while he was speaking, he said something to the effect that homosexuality is so wicked, so vile, so disgusting, so shameful, so abhorrent, so abominable that even dogs and cats don't practice it. And you should have seen the anger. And see, today we don't say those kind of things. Oh, that's not loving. No, it's loving to point out to them what their vileness is to God. Charles Spurgeon once said that homosexuality brought hell out of heaven upon Sodom. So they have a pride flag. I want us to see today that true believers have a flag to fly. It's not the Christian flag. It's not the American flag. We have a flag. You got the world's flag of lies and deception. We're tempted to fly our own flag. Each of us individually are tempted to fly our own flag. But God has given us a flag to fly because of the truth, and we must fly it always. Especially in this time of trouble and war against wickedness. I read this in Psalm 60, verse 4. Listen closely. Thou hast given a banner. The word banner means flag. To them that fear thee, that it may be displayed because of the truth. That's Psalm 60, verse 4. That word, that it may be displayed. Displayed has the idea of to cause to flee. Thou hast given a banner, a flag to them that fear thee, that it may cause to flee because of the truth. In fact, turn there to Psalm 60. I want you to see the context of what is being said here. Psalm chapter 60, verse 5. Verse 4 is what I read. I'll read it again. Thou hast given a banner to them that fear thee, that it may be displayed because of the truth. Look at verse 5. That thy beloved may be delivered, save with thy right hand, and hear me. Jump down to verse 11. Give us help from trouble, for vain is the help of man. Through God we shall do valiantly, for he it is that shall tread down our enemies. Yes, God has given us a banner. Those of us who fear him, he has given us a flag that it may be displayed because of the truth. Moses speaks of such a flag in Exodus chapter 17. And that's where I'd like to preach this morning, out of Exodus chapter 17. Here is a banner. A flag that symbolizes God's war with wickedness and war with wicked people. I'm going to read chapter 17 of Exodus, verses 14, 15, and 16 to start with. Verse 14, and the Lord said unto Moses, write this for a memorial in a book and rehearse it in the ears of Joshua, for I will utterly put out the remembrance of Amalek from under heaven. And Moses built an altar and called the name of it Jehovah Nissi. That literally means the Lord is my flag. The Lord is my banner. For he said, verse 16, because the Lord hath sworn that the Lord will have war with Amalek from generation to generation. Here is the God-fearing man's banner of truth. You see, the children of Israel, verses 1 through 7 of chapter 17, had faced the adversity of the wilderness. We mistakenly think that walking with God results in a smooth path. And they're walking with God up until chapter 17. I mean, they're complaining a lot. But God is sending them constant adversity, problems, and difficulties. All of those things that they had faced were providential. Now they get to chapter 17, and they come to a place called Rephidim. And here in Rephidim, they need water. They chide with Moses in verse 2, say, give us water that we may drink. Moses cries to the Lord in verse 4, what shall I do unto this people? They're ready to stone me. And the Lord says in verse 5, go on before the people, take with thee the elders of Israel and thy rod, wherewith thou smotest the river, take in thine hand and go. And God gives them water. And I want you to notice that the difficulties that they faced in the wilderness, according to verse 1, that their being there was according to the commandment of the Lord. So the difficulties they face are due to following in the Lord. You know, you think that things are going to go smooth because you're a Christian. Just the opposite. God often takes us into areas of difficulty according to his command. That's what happened to the children of Israel. Why? To teach them something. And so you've got the adversity of the wilderness in verses 1 through 7. But I want us to see this morning the adversity of war that follows in verses 8 to 16. But I want you to note what they say in the last part of verse 7 before I get into those verses. They tempted the Lord, saying, is the Lord among us or not? Now, the adversity of war. Notice the first word of verse 8. Then. So after the adversity of the wilderness in verses 1 through 7, then came Amalek and fought with Israel in Rephidim. God's blessing of water in the previous verses is possibly the cause of the enemy to attack. Water is like gold in the wilderness. God had provided them water, and the very thing that God provides them is what the enemy wants and needs. And I want you to note that Israel does not attack them. Verse 8 says, the Amalekites attack Israel. You know what? You can liken this to how our flesh, like Amalek, does the attacking. Your flesh never allows you as a believer to live in peace. Has anybody battled Amalek this past week? If not, there's probably something wrong with you spiritually. All of us battle Amalek, our flesh, all the time. In fact, Paul puts it this way in Galatians chapter 5. The fighting, the contending, the battle of the flesh with the spirit and the spirit against the flesh, it's constant. Then he lists those works of the flesh, and then he lists the fruit of the spirit. It says, now walk in the spirit. Why? Because your flesh is going to rise up against you. Folks, that's Amalek. That's Amalek. Why do they attack? For water. The possession of water was frequently a matter of contention. You see, the Amalekites were desert dwellers, and they want that water. They want that water. And so they do the attacking. They want the blessings God has given Israel. It's interesting how people want the blessings of Christianity without knowing the one who gives the blessings. And you will be attacked simply because you've got a strong family, because you've got a strong church, because you've got a marriage that is glorifying to God. And you know, people don't like that when their marriages are falling apart, when their families are falling apart. It's not fair that you have water and we don't. Verse 8, we see that Amalek comes and fights with Israel. Verse 9, Moses said unto Joshua, this is the first mention of Joshua, and he's called in Exodus 24, 13, the minister of Moses. And so the Moses said unto Joshua, choose us men and go out, fight with Amalek. Tomorrow I will stand on the top of the hill with the rod of God in mine hand. The rod of God. Now I want you to note Joshua's immediate faith and obedience. This is the first battle these people are facing as they've come out of Egypt. These men are not trained for battle. They're unseasoned. And so certainly whatever takes place here, if they have victory, it's not their skill, it's not their military genius that would win this battle. There's no way. So Moses in verse 9 goes to the summit of a hill, not as a spectator, but I'm going to say he goes as a spectacle. Spectacle is a negative word. We think of something spectacle, it's a negative. No, a spectacle can be positive. There he is on the top of the hill, and he has the rod of God in his hand. This is Moses displaying his dependence upon God, evidenced by upholding the rod of God. Now I want you to see six things in the following verses about Moses' uplifted hands. We see in verse 10, so Joshua did as Moses had said to him and fought with Amalek and Moses. And it came to pass when Moses held up his hand that Israel prevailed. And when he let down his hand, Amalek prevailed. So I want you to note, first of all, in verse 11, that Moses' uplifted hands are critical. His having his hand up in the air, his hands with that rod, is critical for victory in battle, because as soon as he lets those his hands down, there's defeat. So there's to these soldiers, as they look up and they see his hands up and they see that rod, the rod of God, it is to them somewhat of an ensign, a standard, some kind of a banner or a flag, although it's not used for that. It's later on used for an altar that is built in commemoration of this. They see his hands up and they prevail in battle. I was reading once about a guy by the name of William Kearney. This took place in 1863. He was 23 years old. He had joined the 54th Massachusetts Infantry. 5 months later, after he had joined, he saw action at the failed assault on Fort Wagner, and the Union suffered 30% casualties. One of those who was killed near William Kearney was a color guard, the flag bearer. Seeing his comrade hit, Kearney kept the honor of the flag by preventing it from touching the ground, as that Sergeant Wall was his name, fell dead. So here's this man rushing into battle. This guy next to him gets shot or near him, and he sees him falling and he rushes to get the flag to keep that flag from touching the ground. Almost immediately, Kearney was shot through the leg. Yet he remained standing with the flag. Instead of retreating to get medical attention, Kearney hoisted the flag high and marched towards the fort despite sustaining serious wounds. When his Union forces were compelled to retreat, he struggled back across the battlefield. In so doing, he was shot in the chest, shot in the arm, and again shot in the leg during his retreat, but he refused to let the flag touch the ground. When another bullet caused a grazing wound to his head, Kearney still refused to let the flag go. He refused help from a soldier from another regiment. When he finally reached the safety of his retreated regiment, Kearney passed on the flag and collapsed, saying, "Boys, I only did my duty. The flag never touched the ground." Although the wounds of Kearney's were often a death sentence during the Civil War, he recovered and kept all his limbs. He posed with the very same flag for a picture before being medically discharged and becoming a mail carrier in Massachusetts. At age 60, he finally received the Medal of Honor for his actions. You can go online and see a picture of him holding that flag years later. Do not let the flag touch the ground. I give you that illustration because here's the point. As long as those men saw the flag, the standard, the ensign standing, it symbolized something. We're still going. I mean, what does the Star Spangled Banner say? Oh, say, does that flag still wave? What was it that gave people encouragement, Francis Scott Key, was that the fact that in the War of 1812, that battle still stood there in Baltimore over Fort McHenry. It symbolized something. And Moses standing on top of the hill with his hands raised, it symbolized something. And that's what I want you to see secondly. Moses' uplifted hands are not only critical, they're symbolic. Perhaps emblematic of prayer. It's dependence. And that's one of the main points I want you to get. It is an ensign, a flag of dependence. Listen to Psalm 28, verse 2. Where the psalmist says this, "Hear the voice of my supplications when I cry unto thee, when I lift up my hands toward thy holy oracle." Uplifted hands are symbolic. But here's something you will know, that my third point, verse 12. But Moses' hands were heavy. Uplifted hands are heavy. How long can you keep your hands up? Now put something in them. How long can you do it? Just keep them up. It's easy to tire of praying. If indeed these uplifted hands are symbolic of prayer, it is easy to get tired in praying. Prayer is work. If you come to prayer thinking this is going to be easy, and you don't know, you're probably not praying, because prayer is work. I remember one Wednesday night, people got to the service. Some of you may have been to this Wednesday night service. This is years ago. And he said, "Are you all ready to go to work?" And everybody looked at me like, "We didn't come here to work." And I was referring to praying. We're going to be praying here in a few minutes. Are you ready to go to work? You see, Jesus said, men ought always to pray and not to faint. And when we lose that spirit of dependency expressed by our praying, Amalek prevails. The flesh prevails. Moses' uplifted hands are critical, symbolic, heavy. Last part of verse 12, Moses' uplifted hands are supported. Moses' hands were heavy, it says in verse 12, and they took a stone and put it under him, and he sat thereon, and Aaron and Hur stayed up his hands, the one on the one side and the other on the other side, and his hands were steady until the going down of the sun. Moses was not left alone. His hands, his heavy hands, are supported. You know, we have this expression to uplift somebody else in prayer. You ever heard that expression? Wednesday nights, folks, are when we uplift one another in prayer. And by the way, we need more Aarons and hers, to uplift in prayer. I've gone to conferences and meetings where people will be praying, and or they'll be standing there and they're waving their hands, which is to me a tremendous distraction. And they use this verse. Well, it says in 1 Timothy 2:8, I will therefore that men pray everywhere, lifting up holy hands without wrath and doubting. See, there's the reason we uplift our hands. But in uplifting hands in Exodus chapter 17, what is the uplifting of hands? It's the uplifting of someone else's hands, holy hands, a symbol of praying, a dependence upon God. Moses' uplifted hands require support. How can you support someone else? How can you lift up other people's hands? One way is through praying. Verse 13. For my fifth point, Moses' uplifted hands are discomfiting to the enemy. Look at what it says in verse 13. And Joshua discomfited Amalek and his people with the edge of the sword. Now, notice that word discomfited. It means to overwhelm, to disable. Now, also, the sword is mentioned. The rod is in the hand of Moses. The sword is in the hand of Joshua. I find the sword and prayer mentioned together in Ephesians chapter 6, verses 17 and 18. And take the sword of the Spirit, which is the word of God, praying always with all prayer and supplication in the Spirit. I like George Bush said, and this is not the president, this is a commentator back in the 1800s. He said about this verse, in vain had Moses prayed if Joshua had not fought. In vain had Joshua fought if Moses had not prayed. Moses' uplifted hands are discomfiting to the enemy, disabling to the enemy. They discomfited Amalek. Discomfort your flesh. How? By gritting your teeth, right? No, by going to the Lord in prayer. Note that the enemy, by the way, is only discomfited, not defeated. The enemy is disabled. Your flesh will always come back. Amalek will always return. Here they win the battle, but they don't win the war. And it keeps us humble, and it keeps us dependent. Your struggle with the flesh is a lifelong war. And sometimes Christians have the impression, okay, one day I'm going to get victory, complete victory. In fact, the old-time Methodists used to teach this perfectionism. Okay, one day I'm going to have complete victory, sin is no longer going to bother me, and they got into what is called perfectionism. No, it's a lifelong battle. Go to Deuteronomy, keeping your finger there in Exodus 17. Go to Deuteronomy chapter 25. In Deuteronomy 25, Moses recalls what is taking place in Exodus 17. Deuteronomy 25, 17. Remember what Amalek did unto you by the way when ye were come forth out of Egypt. How he met thee by the way and smote the hindmost of thee, even all that were feeble behind thee when thou wast weary, when thou wast faint and weary, and he feared not God. So Moses, in this recollection of that battle, talks about the hindmost. These are the stragglers. So the stragglers, those who were faint and those who were weary, were smitten by the enemy. Isaiah chapter 40 gives the remedy when you're faint and when you're weary. He puts it this way, he giveth power to the faint. Isaiah 40, 29. And to them that have no might, he increaseth strength. Even the youths shall faint and be weary, and the young men shall utterly fail. But they that wait upon the Lord shall renew their strength. They shall mount up with wings as eagles. They shall run and not be weary. They shall walk and not faint. Only in God's power can you go. Amalek always seems to find us when we are at our weakest. The flesh always raises its ugly head when you are the weakest. When you're sick, when you're tired, when you're about to give up, Amalek is there. Your flesh is there. Folks, the remedy is dependence upon God. The psalmist put it this way, as for me, my feet were almost gone. My steps had well nigh slipped until I went into the sanctuary of God. Then understood I the enemy's end. Surely thou didst set them in a slippery place. Thou castest them down into destruction. How are they brought into desolation as in a moment they are utterly consumed with terrors? You're at your wit's end. You're tired of all the battling. You're tired of everything that's taking place in our country, in our society. And your feet almost slip. Solution? Until I went into the sanctuary of God. Then I was able to see what's going to happen to them. God is going to make their feet slippery. They're going to be on thin ice. And they'll go into destruction. Moses' uplifted hands are critical. Symbolic of prayer. Heavy, but supported. Discomfiting the enemy. Lastly, Moses' uplifted hands are permanently memorialized. He builds an altar, verse 14, we've already read it, and he names it Jehovah Nissi. The Lord is my banner. The Lord is my flag. And so here's a monument, this altar, not to Joshua or the brave soldiers, but God. And it's interesting that these words are spoken by Moses, because in the previous verses it is clear that Israel prevailed when he held up his hands. Amalek prevailed when his hands were down. It would be tempting for Israel to perceive the victory in battle. Hey, Moses, hold your hands up again. Folks, it is not that Moses held his hands up. It is why Moses held his hands up, with the rod of God displaying dependence upon God himself. And observers today of victorious Christian men think that the victory is due to some kind of an outward ritual, due to some kind of an act of your flesh, and that, oh, you're so strong and I really admire you and how you really seem to have always, you always seem to have victory. Why is that? Dependence upon God. It's not just simply having your devotions and praying. It's having your devotions and praying. You said, you just said the same thing. I know, but there's a difference. Simply just having your devotions and praying with, I must have my time with the Lord. I must pray. Because I depend upon Him. Moses defines the true source of his victory. It's Jehovah. It's Yahweh. Folks, we wage a war against the flesh with symbolically lifting up our hands to heaven. I'm not talking about a physical lifting up of your hands, a spiritual lifting up of your hands. We follow Moses' gesture, not physically, but spiritually. Recognizing that without Jehovah Nissi, I can do nothing. So yes, I have my devotions, not as a ritual, but as dependence upon God. There's another time when the children of Israel fought these same people. This is the time when they sent the 12 spies out. They came back and 10 gave an evil report and 2 gave a good report. And they listened to the men who gave the evil report. And when Moses said that you're going to wander in this wilderness for 40 years, they said, okay, we're going to go fight. Fighting Amalek again, they were one of the enemies. They went back to fight in their own strength. They were depending upon their own strength now because Moses said, God's not with you. They are not under his banner. Numbers 14:43 says, they turned away from the Lord. And folks, if your flag is your own determination, you're going to be defeated. Your flag can be your own determination. I could do this. That's your pride flag. Amalek was the grandson of Esau. Balaam was caused to prophesy against him and mentioned that he was the first of those who had warred against Israel. And I've already read Deuteronomy 25:17-19, where Moses had exhorted Israel to exterminate them when they come into the land. There he recalls Exodus 17 and how they attacked us. And later on, the first king of Israel was given responsibility to go and destroy Amalek. His name? King Saul. Because God had said, I will have war with Amalek from generation to generation. It's going to be an ongoing war. Saul, go and destroy them. And what does Saul do? He compromises in this battle. He takes the sheep. He saves the king in direct disobedience to God. He failed, so Samuel had to finish the job. Here's the principle. God does not forget those who afflict his people. He will not forget. He brings certain judgment upon them. God does repay with affliction those who afflict his own. In fact, the Bible says when Jesus returns in the air, 2 Thessalonians 1:6, seeing it is a righteous thing with God to recompense tribulation to them that trouble you, Jesus Christ comes back in flaming fire, taking vengeance on them that know not God and that obey not the gospel of the Lord Jesus Christ. Now I go back to verse 7, the last part, where God's people had doubted the Lord in verse 7 and said, is the Lord among us or not? The real question should have been, Will we depend upon Jehovah or not? Their victory against Amalek is like our victory in the Christian life when Jehovah Nissi is a fact, when Jehovah is your flag. There's going to be ongoing warfare. The Lord will have war with Amalek from generation to generation. But you have been given a banner. Those of you who fear God, you have been given a banner that it may be displayed because of the truth. So this week, as we proudly fly the American banner, and I use the word banner because that's how it's used in the King James here, I want you to be reminded of a banner displayed because of the truth that literally causes the enemy to flee. America has been able to fly her red, white, and blue banner because to some degree, historically, Jehovah Nissi has been true. But to the Christian, Jehovah Nissi is true, not to some degree, but to full degree. What is your banner? Our banner is Yahweh, Jehovah. We go forth in His name. Onward, Christian soldiers. That's our banner. That is your banner as an individual Christian. You can't fight the battle on your own. You need Christians uplifting you in prayer. You need to uplift other Christians in prayer. We need to pray for each other. We need to uphold each other in prayer. We need to uphold our missionaries in prayer. We need to support people in prayer. If you need prayer, don't forget that other people need prayer too. It expresses our dependence upon God. Jehovah, you are our banner.